from Springfield. This is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
They are calling for peaceful but meaningful defiance.
Say his name!
George Floyd!
There is an inherent systemic problem with not only the police department, but with this government.
That's why this moment is so damn important. And the righteous anger, people coming out of their homes, flooding into the streets.
I've watched as protesters hurled not just words, but projectiles at our police department. Bottles of water, urine, and Lord knows what else. I saw protesters armed with shovels, bats, hammers, and metal pipes.
I hope this don't just not no one week thing. We stay mad for a week and forget about this. Let's keep going. Let's keep the battle going. They want to keep killing us, we're going to keep going. That's our problem. We got to be consistent.
If we don't keep pressing, then nothing will get done. We have to keep coming back, no matter how small the number of people get. If we keep showing up, we'll get attention. It doesn't matter.
Well, just some of the many voices heard this past week as protesters took to the streets calling attention to police brutality in the wake of George Floyd's death in Minneapolis. Protests not just in Chicago, across the country, of course, and across the state. There was some violence and looting. The governor called up National Guard troops to help keep the peace, but the Chicago mayor, Lori Lightfoot, rejected President Trump's idea to have the federal military involved. And we'll talk about all of that and more on State Week. In Springfield, I'm Sean Crawford. Our panel is practicing social distancing once again. From his home, we have Charlie Wheeler, an emeritus professor and former director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield, and also a longtime State House reporter and observer. Joining us as well, NPR Illinois reporter Sam Dunklaw. And our guest this week is Maudlin Ihajarika. She is a Sun-Times columnist and also president of the National Association of Black Journalists Chicago chapter, as well as president of the Chicago Journalists Association. Maudlin, very good to have you with us for the first time here on State Week.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
And let me go to you first, because you've been in Chicago, and of course, we've all been seeing on television a lot of the activity that's been taking place there, the protests this week. I wanted to get your thoughts on what you're seeing, just from your vantage point there. What do you make of everything that's taken place just in the last several days?
Well, what we're seeing is a tipping point. The murder, and that's what it was, the murder of George Floyd was simply the latest in a long line of deaths of Black men and Black women, actually, in police custody or during arrest. And George Floyd simply ripped a Band-Aid off a festering wound of racism that too often seeps into America's policing. It started in Minneapolis and it started peacefully. But what we saw was that, there are always in every protest, in every just cause, a certain element that seeks to tar the message. And so we had provocateurs come in, those who were simply interested in violence, those who represented alt-right groups and others, who sought to sow chaos. And so we started seeing the arson and the violence. And then, of course, we always have a faction during every protest and just cause that seeks self-gain to take advantage. And so we saw that in those who use the opportunity to begin looting. And this has, been a wave across the country. The key here, though, is that the protests that we are seeing are unlike any that perhaps those of us of my generation in our 50s have seen since the civil rights movement. It is a wave of protests that has swept the country, a jolting of the American consciousness that we have an issue that has been festering and can no longer be allowed to go on. And so those are separate and apart from the looting and the destruction, but unfortunately interweaved with some of the episodes of police brutality and police misconduct that we saw during the protest. So you have those who are doing wrong, you have the violent, you have the looters, and then you have police who react the way that has led us to where we are today, that has led to these protests. We saw police driving into crowds. We saw National Guard walking through a neighborhood, shooting canisters of I don't know what they were, at residents on their front porches. We saw in Chicago, several police officers grab a woman by her hair, rip her out of the car, throw her on the ground, and put their knee in her neck, as if they've been under a rock and did not know what started all of this. So that's where we are. That's what we're seeing. They're beginning to taper off. And I think that, you know, we're in a place where the nation has to confront its policing, its tactics, and how they've been allowed to go on for so long. And it's ignited many, many critical and important conversations, and not the least of which are occurring right here in the city of Chicago, one of the most segregated cities in the nation, and certainly in a police department that has been plagued by racism and police misconduct lawsuits for many years.
And I do want to get back to some of what you talked about. I'm going to move to Charlie, who, of course, I guess Charlie is of an advanced age, I should be nice about it, to remember a lot of the protests that Maudlin was mentioning that go even farther back, the civil rights marches, and a lot of the violence, you know, that we saw back in those days as well. Get your thoughts on what you're seeing now and maybe in comparison to that period.
Well, I think one of the big differences nowadays, which didn't exist back in the days when I started as a reporter at the Sun-Times in April of 1969, is the cell phones with video capabilities that are almost everywhere. If what happened in Minneapolis would have happened 20 years ago, and for all I know, it probably did the same kind of thing, and there hadn't been a video of it that went viral, would there have been any kind of upset or outrage outside of the near environs? Or if there was not a person with a cell phone videoing when the two women were thrown from their car in the brickyard in Chicago by Chicago police, would there have been any uproar about it beyond the family of the women or the elderly man in Buffalo who was pushed to the ground by police? I think that's one of the big differences, is that now people can see evidence, graphic evidence, of what has been going on for a very long time and was not as, and reporters would write about this stuff, but it's not as effective, I don't think, seeing the written word as it is actually seeing the picture of a man with a cop kneeling on his throat, on his neck, suffocating him. I mean, that kind of dramatic thing, I think, enrages people and awakens people's conscience in a way that wasn't possible back, say, 40 years ago, 50 years ago, or I guess now it would be closer to 60 years ago.
Yeah, and Maudlin, let me get your thoughts on that as well. The video has really been a difference maker here, because you could always have, you know, two different sides to an argument, especially if you have no video proof of something that took place. Pretty hard right now to hear anybody who's on the side of what took place, what the Minnesota police officer did, because we have the video evidence.
And that's absolutely right. You know, this particular video, there's no way that you could watch the knee that was pressed to George Floyd's neck as he writhed and cried in agony, and hear the white woman and the black man that were nearby plead for George Floyd's life to no avail, and watch the life seep from Mr. Floyd's body until he stopped moving and then stopped breathing. And then watch Officer Chauvin remain on Mr. Floyd's neck for an additional two minutes and some 56 or 46 seconds after he stopped moving and breathing without feeling trauma. I think that what this nation suffered was a collective PTSD. We watched this video and we were sickened, we were disgusted, we were in agony, we were befuddled, we were baffled, we could not believe we were watching this in the United States of America. And as Charlie says, the only reason that we were able to see this and that we were able to have this triggering of mass emotion is because of the cell phone, because of video, because of the technology. These sorts of incidents, unfortunately, happen day after day. And we have to know that because we know that it is only few and far between that someone captures it on video, such as the incident in Chicago's Brickyard Mall, such as the old man that was pushed down and ignored as he bled, such as the cars that were the police cars ramming into protesters. So many of these videos that have clogged the internet and social media in recent days, it is only because today technology allows us to occasionally capture examples of what is wrong with America.
Sam, let me go to you because, like she mentioned there, you're talking about people being very upset. They're coming out. The protests have taken place in Chicago. That's probably not surprising. We've seen that in some major cities. What I've been really surprised about more here has been small towns. I mean, it's towns in southern Illinois. We have seen a really good turnout in a lot of those locations. And people coming out and saying this is not right. So it has spread beyond just the urban areas of the country.
It absolutely has, Sean. Two contemporary examples here in central Illinois even, and southern Illinois, as you mentioned. Just in the last couple of days, Taylorville, Illinois, outside of Springfield, had a very large turnout. And Taylorville is in a county that is almost 100% white. I mean, I believe Taylorville itself is either 96 or 98% white. And the turnout of protesters there, all peaceful, were quite eye-catching from some of the reporters that were there. And then, as you mentioned, southern Illinois, a protest in Anna, Illinois, which is notorious throughout the state as being one of Illinois' worst sundown towns. Some residents wearing that designation as a badge of honor, and yet several hundred protesters staged a demonstration there in Anna to highlight some of the things that protesters across the country are doing. So I should mention too, here in Springfield, protests have been going on since this past weekend, ranging in size from a few hundred folks to well over a few thousand. And organizers here, and I can imagine in other places too, say that they are not going to stop until real reforms are presented by either local or state leaders.
I don't want to overshadow, though, that, you know, while there has been a lot of peaceful protesting, Marlon, you mentioned there was a lot of violence in some locations, as well as in communities of color. And I've heard from, you know, some lawmakers who've talked about this, also some activists who have, you know, talked about the fact that these areas need to be rebuilt after this. There has been, you know, grocery stores that have been burned and looted. There have been many black-owned businesses that are now destroyed. What's the next step? Where does it go from here?
Well, you know, that's part of the problem. We saw this same thing occur in 1968 with the riots in the wake of the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. And in Chicago, specifically, on the West Side, the rioting that led to mass destruction of property and looting, the area has never recovered. You know, this is 50 something years later, and you can still find vacant lots where property was burned down. business districts where that are marked with boarded up buildings and vacant lots. And so what we've seen is prior to this, a lack of will by the powers that be and city government in Chicago particularly to rebuild these areas. And driven by the sort of racism that created the intensely segregated urban area that is Chicago. And so we've had, mayors, and I'll call some names. This occurred in the Daley era, who felt, well, they burned it down, and so let them live with it. And mayors after him who felt like that was not a priority. Those segregated, predominantly minority, marginalized areas were the least of their priorities. And so it has remained so. So when we look at what has happened in the past week, what we know is that these areas must be rebuilt. What we know is that we cannot go down the same road that we went down after 1968, that we cannot allow urban areas that were impacted by this sort of destruction to remain the way they are. Today, there must be a will on the part of government and the powers that be to do things differently. Because today, we have to recognize that these things occurred because of racism. These things occurred because of systemic inequalities. These things occurred because peaceful protesters who wanted to call attention to these sorts of inequities were then taken advantage of by agent provocateurs and criminal factions. And so we cannot turn a blind eye and say, let it remain, let it stand. Because if we do, then we are supporting the institutional racism that wrought this situation to begin with.
Shirley, the Illinois Legislative Black Caucus, at least members of the Black Caucus, got together this week and talked about the need for a special session to deal with some of the issues, maybe about policing, of course. But there were other matters that were brought up, including a discussion about coming up with some type of funds for just what Maudlin was mentioning there, rebuilding some of these communities after violence has occurred, including the use of the state's capital program. Any thoughts on that? Any thoughts if that actually could gain traction?
I look at it and thinking about all this, and the protests have highlighted the disparate treatment of people of color by police forces, by some members of police forces. But at the same time, I think the pandemic has revealed how those areas in Chicago, on the South Side and on the West Side, have been, I don't know what the right word would be, I don't know if it is underinvested would be correct, but in terms of like healthcare facilities, there's not the kind of healthcare facilities, there's not the kind of grocery facilities, pharmacies that you find in more affluent neighborhoods. And so the pandemic has wreaked much greater havoc among folks living in those neighborhoods than in the wealthier neighborhoods. And there was a study that came out not too long ago that showed a far disproportionate investment by banks in wealthy neighborhoods as opposed to in lower income neighborhoods. So the police brutality is the most egregious thing, or the most visible thing, thanks to videos, but the underlying disinvestment in communities of color has been ongoing for a long time. And like Maudlin said, the white establishment more or less decided to write off the black areas. And Chicago is very segregated, and the unwritten line going from north to south, beyond which blacks weren't allowed to move, has moved westward over time. But there's still neighborhoods that are almost totally black, other neighborhoods that are almost totally white. And that's not by accident. That's been conscious design by the powers that be, the investment community, the titans of industry, who've chosen to make themselves rich at the expense of everybody else.
Let me come back to that in a moment, but Sam, real quick, since we are talking about the powers that be, we do have a governor in the state, J.B. Pritzker. This week he was asked to bring up some National Guard troops. That was a request came from the Chicago mayor, Lori Lightfoot. Some troops did go into the Chicago area and other places to help. Right now, Pritzker, in my opinion, has sort of had to walk a fine line on this issue. He seems like, you know, he's certainly siding with the peaceful protesters. Of course, he's not in favor of violence that's taking place, but I haven't heard a whole lot more from him about what the state plans to do. Has there been more discussion there from the governor?
Well, one piece of conversation that's been coming up quite a bit in the last couple of days is whether or not the state legislature would call a special session, as was mentioned earlier. Some members of the Black Caucus calling for that. Now, some of the folks that are arguing for that say that, you know, there's specific legislative proposals that ought to be taken up right now because of the civil unrest that's happening. The trouble, though, is that Pritzker, in responding to that, said, well, that'll be okay if the two legislative leaders in the Senate and in the House both agreed to do so. Now, the latest this morning is that Senate President Don Harmon is still sort of rallying and getting together all the folks from the Senate Black Caucus, while House Speaker Michael Madigan does not appear ready to agree to such a special session. So that's just in terms of direct policy. But Sean, as you were mentioning, Pritzker has tried to walk a fine line with the deployment of the National Guard, with the calling for a disaster proclamation in a number of Illinois counties to get relief to businesses who may have been looted. But at the same time, he has been quite bold on the national stage in calling President Trump during a phone call with governors this week, saying that Trump's rhetoric was very concerning, that the way it should be the duty of the White House to bring down the temperature, and some of the tweets and actions that the president has taken in the last week have, in Pritzker's opinion, run counter to that, to which Trump responded, well, I don't really like your rhetoric either, sort of brushing off that criticism quite handily. It's not a stretch that Pritzker would do that sort of thing. Pritzker's been calling out the Trump White House since he started running for governor a number of years ago. That's all to say that I think on the ground, Pritzker says the right things. Doing some of the things that have been called for by protesters, that have been called for by activists and even legislators, that remains to be seen.
Just a couple of minutes left here, we could talk about this for, you know, all day long, but I did want to get, Maudlin, your thoughts on the governor and also on Mayor Lightfoot here and the position that they're in when it comes to not just the protests that are taking place, but they're hearing from, you know, other constituents as well, concerned about violence, concerned about some of the damage that's been done. To get your thoughts on how they've done so far in this.
Well, you know, I think that I have to give both Pritzker and Lightfoot an overall good grade on the way they've handled these protests. Pritzker, I think, has had less of a burden in that he can weigh in from afar, and so he can listen to. He can gauge the mindset of the mayor and all the other cities in the state, and then respond to what they want. And so to say that I'm only going to send 375 National Guard troops to Chicago because that's what Mayor Lightfoot wants does not really fall on him. It's easy for him to then take the credit for the perspective that has driven that decision by Chicago's mayor, which is that Chicago cannot afford to be seen with its intense race issues, because Chicago is a hotbed of race issues and segregation. And Chicago cannot afford to be seen as utilizing a militarized response, because it has been at the heart of the criticism by the Black community about the inequities that are wrought throughout the city by the policing department, and also the institutional racism that divides, as Charlie was saying, North from South and West, and Black from white, and Latino from white, and et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, these communities have long complained that their communities are where the intense policing occurs, and that they are akin to military zones. And therefore, Lightfoot understood that to then respond in a military way would only be adding fuel to the fire. So Pritzker gets good marks, but he only gets good marks through default. You know, it was easy for him to look good on that issue because he was responding to the mayor. As for Lightfoot, you know, Lightfoot gets, I would say, a C. She gets a C. She doesn't get an A because she unfortunately left the South and West sides of Chicago undefended in a significant way in the height of the looting and violence and destruction. And therefore, as she sent the majority of the resources downtown to protect our wealthy business district, the South and West sides were not covered as they should have been and suffered tremendously before the powers that be understood that, oh no, they have gone to the South and West sides, and then began scrambling. And no matter what she says about, oh, it was happening so fast that no amount of police could have responded, it's clear that the criticism by some aldermen of these communities that you did not know what you were doing, and your plan was not sufficient, and you didn't think this through, and you thought only of the wealthy, predominantly white downtown district. You did not have a citywide plan until it was too late. So she gets a C, but she is in her first term. And I have to say that for a first term mayor, you know, a rookie that is dealing with all the things that have happened since in the last year that she was elected, the pandemic, the Chicago economy, the protests, the destruction, she's doing a pretty good job. And the C is simply a wait and see.
That's our time for this episode of State Week. Our panel included Charlie Wheeler, Sam Dunklaw, and the Sun-Times columnist Maudlin Ihedrarica. You can get a podcast of our show at nprillinois.org or through the NPR One app, and our production assistance for the program was provided by Bob Meyer. I'm Sean Crawford.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capital by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.